The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I just came back from teaching for a week at IRC, and the people who are responsible for IRC spent a lot of time discussing the coronavirus, and because people come there and gather place for live together for a week at a time, and so how do we take that into account, all the possible scenarios of what might come. And so in some ways at IRC we're kind of leading the discussion in terms of IMC, and so IMC is just starting up now, a serious discussion about how to better take care of this building, people who come here, and there's already some efforts to sanitizing, disinfecting, and things like that. So it's all in progress. And but what I want to say about this is that, you know, that we're we hopefully live a wise, practical life in the world, but you know, in Buddhism we also live a wise spiritual life in the world, and for that, I'm kind of delighted by the, at least in my little mind, that every time I hear the expression coronavirus, I hear Karuna virus. And Karuna is the Sanskrit Pali word for compassion. And wouldn't that be nice if there was a compassion virus that somehow spread and you know, we all got it. But more importantly than just a play on the words, I think that a really important part of what we contend with, work with in Buddhist practice is the degree to which we are self-focused and the degree to which we are other-focused. And what's the balance for that? What's the right place for that here and there? And I think if we think of this as, you know, that the play on those, that word, corona and karuna, as being kind of pointing to both directions, that for some people, the primary concern around this current pandemic of flu that's being spread is mostly how to protect themselves. And it turns out that most of the ways that we protect ourselves are ways of protecting others too. And I think it actually to spend more time perhaps change the balance a little bit to so that you're actually thinking more about others than yourself. And you'll be protecting yourself at the same time. And what way I think about this is that, you know, that we're all to the degree to which we're all potentially can get some virus like this or any kind of cold or flu or something, we're also the carriers of it, the transmitters of it. In fact, probably for most colds and flus that go around, we're probably, all of us are probably more frequently transmitters, carriers of it, more than we actually get the thing ourselves. And so if that's the case, then I think it, you know, it's kind of nice to shift whatever balance you have to live your life now in this new corona world, thinking about others and thinking about how to support and care for others. And so, you know, how you wash your hands, how you use commonly touched items, what you do when you have a sniffle, or all kinds of ways that how could you be in the world to make it better for others, as opposed to how can I protect myself? And you might end up doing it from the outside, it looks like you're doing exactly the same, but your heart will feel so much more different in terms of this, you know, the spiritual Buddhist side. It your whole demeanor and way to life will probably be a lot better if you shift the directionality of what you're caring for. And I think it probably has health benefits, because to operate under fear, my guess is psychology affects physiology, and fear probably is not a good thing for our immune system, but compassion is. And if it's the same behavior, choose the compassion side. So when you hear corona, maybe you'll hear compassion and think about how that's how you can live. So is that okay for now on that topic? Okay. So, besides that topic, since I was on retreat this last week, I don't have anything new to think about except for the theme of the retreat. So that's what I'd like to share with you. I taught the retreat with two wonderful teachers, Don Scott and Nisha Patel, and we shared the theme through the week, and so it was kind of like what we were massaging and working, and I thought I was inspired by the theme, and so maybe some of my talking today can share that inspiration. So the theme, the title or the concept that was talked about in and of itself might not sound inspiring. And the common way of saying it in English, the common English term is the five faculties. Are you inspired yet? And the five faculties are five abilities that we have. It could be called five abilities that are activated, engaged in doing every activity we do in life. But, you know, for Buddhist meditation practice, we look at how these five are activated in Buddhist practice. Now, the word for that we translated as faculties, occasionally you see people translated as the five controlling faculties. And the word control is not very popular in Buddhist circles in the United States, because maybe partly because some people control too much, trying to control everything, and learning to relax and not control everything is an important step in people's. So it's not that often you hear them translated as controlling faculties, but occasionally. What's more interesting is what the Pali name is, the Buddhist word that's being translated as faculties. It's indriya. And indriya means something like of the god Indra. And Indra is a god of mostly of ancient India and Vedic times, and came into Buddhism. It was a well-respected god in ancient Buddhism, and had certain qualities, this Indra. Indra was considered a friend of Buddhists, friend of the Buddha. It's kind of also a protector god, and protected people, and associated with protecting people from evil and bringing beneficial nourishment and nutriment into people's lives. So it was a kind of a benevolent figure. But Indra was also for a certain period of time, the ruler of the heavens, the ruler of the gods. So of Indra. So here, in this wonderful way, which the Buddha sometimes reframed, flipped things around, at least as I read it, is rather than focusing on the deity, divinity that's outside of ourselves, he's pointing to what's divine or the divinity inside of ourselves. That metaphorically, these five faculties have such important role that they are divine or are divinities or associated with this great ruler of the gods. And that says a lot about the early Buddhist view of the human being, that we have these wonderful faculties within us that have huge potential. And their potential to protect us. They have the potential to be our friends and nourish us, protect us from evil or bad tendencies. And they have also the potential to guide us, to lead us, to move us in a good direction. And so in that sense, they're kind of like rulers of our inner life. And what I find fascinating about this is that the idea that there's five capacities inside of us that protect us, that guide us, that kind of control in some way or rule or move us in a healthy, good direction, that are not what we normally would take as being me, myself, and mine. The degree to which we organize ourselves around self, around our self-identity, about me and what I'm supposed to get and what I'm supposed to do, especially in terms of control and accomplishing, doing things. And, I'm in charge. I'm going to protect myself. I'm going to get something. I'm. And here, there's these five things which are within us, but in some ways can feel that we have some, we live in relationship to them, we support them and develop them. They're within us, but they're not us. And to have these powerful things within us, when they become powerful, course through us, and we really feel the goodness and the strength and the power of them as they work through our system, and feel there's something, you know, maybe it's unfortunate to say impersonal about them. That seems kind of dry. But and then we have in California transpersonal, which, there's no longer the Transpersonal Institute of Psychology. It used to be. And now it's Sophia College. You know about that? So they went from this transpersonal idea to the feminine wisdom. So one of the five faculties is wisdom. So something which is within us, but is not what we normally identify as us. And we're evoking them and developing them. So I'll give you the common English names for these five. And as I give this talk, what would be ideal is if, as you listen to it, you identify these in yourself. Not in terms of ideas and, you know, yeah, I guess I have that, I read about that. But rather you recognize it in action, that how they operate for you. And some of the words I'll use initially maybe don't speak for you, and I'll offer other words as well. So commonly, the five are faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. So we begin with faith, which maybe I'm most inspired at the moment to talk about. So maybe that's what's going to get the most press. The Pali word for faith is sada, shraddha in Sanskrit. And I'm beginning to feel like I like to give more of the Pali names in Sanskrit more than I used to, because I'm appreciating how many people come to IMC who have an Indian background. And so when especially you use a Sanskrit, those words mean something for them. It's kind of part of their modern language as well. And so the shraddha or sada is a wonderful term. And it's a term which is kind of a concept or an activity of the heart. When we use the English word faith, it all too often for some people is associated with believing in a creed. Like, this is my faith, and you have not believed something. You have to believe something on faith means you have to believe it based on no evidence whatsoever, but you should believe it. Something like that. But that's certainly not what the sada means in Buddhism. But it's also, what I like to point out is that rather than seeing faith as something we believe, we can maybe see faith as something we believe in if we look at the ancient, the original meaning of the word believe, the etymological source of it. The word believe in the Middle Ages did not refer to the creed in which you adhered to, you know, the ideas that you kind of, this is what, in English we call, I believe in God, or I believe in something. And, you know, it means that you think it's true. The original meaning of believe was what you love, what you hold dear, what you care for. And then you have a whole different feeling for what believe is. What do you love? What do you put your heart into? What do you do wholeheartedly? What do you care for? What do you hold dear? And that has a whole different feeling than in English. The other thing that believe is used for in English, I think is a beautiful expression. When you say, when someone tells you they believe in you, what a great expression. I think to believe in someone means to have confidence in them and kind of really trust and have value who they are, to have some sense, real clear confidence in the direction their life is going and what they're doing. Well, to someone tell you, I believe in you, you know, that's kind of, you know, if, imagine a child being told, maybe, I mean, a child growing up with no one ever telling them that or indicating that. And imagine someone, child growing up with people believing in them. You know, you can do it, you can find your way, and you have value. So what is it that you love? What is it that you care for? What is it that you value and esteem? What, you know, here. And in the early Buddhist tradition, the word sadha had to do specifically, most concretely, about the kind of faith, belief, confidence with which you would start your Buddhist practice as a beginner. You don't know anything about it. You've never meditated, never done any practice at all. And it would be like learning, you know, a musical instrument or learning a craft or something. You've never done it before. And you have to have some faith or belief or confidence. It's worthwhile to learn it. You can do it. And so you would, and that would get you going. And once you got it going for a while and did the training and the instrument, or if you got your, everyone's so self-conscious now. We should hold everybody in our hearts. So you have to, you know, so you start learning your musical instrument or your craft or whatever it is, and after a while, you get the hang of it. You develop a skill, and then it's no longer faith I can do it, but now you have evidence that you can do it, and now you have evidence-based confidence. Yeah, I can do this. You know, so, well, you know, I had to learn how to snap my fingers. Yeah, I remember still learning that as a teeny kid. And, you know, that was hard. Now I don't have faith I can do it. Now I have confidence. At least for now, before my arthritis gets worse. So Buddhist practice is the same way. To have faith is how we get started. And, you know, if you go take a simple class in mindfulness now in the local YMCA or community center or something, where it's available in so many different places, it doesn't take a lot of confidence to do it. It doesn't take a lot of faith. It's just like now your doctor prescribes it or something. Your therapist prescribes it. You know, your mother prescribes it. And so people try it out, you know, without a really high expectation for what it'll do for them. And maybe just a matter of a little bit of stress reduction, which is great. And classically, the Buddhist path was much more than just a little bit of stress reduction or pain relief. It was really a path for liberation. And to really step onto that path for its full potential of freeing the heart from whatever afflicts it, freeing the heart from all the any ways in which it's contracted or limited or held down or caught and tangled in its web of preoccupations and self-concern. To really find freedom from that is a phenomenal path to be on. It's a path of a lifetime. And to step onto that as a beginner takes a little bit higher degree of faith or confidence than it does, just going to the Y for a little bit of, you know, mindfulness. And so the sadha has a very important role. And so how does it get triggered? How does it be awakened enough so that it really becomes something that enlivens us or engages our, something we, this is what I want, this is what I believe in, this is what I'll give faith in, provisional faith in order to try it out. So some people get that from meeting someone else who really somehow embodies some of the qualities of the Dharma or practice or freedom that really inspires them a lot. And certainly that was my case when I was in the early years of practice. Even when I was practicing, I would meet these people and say, wow, this is really speaks to me. This really resonates with something inside of me. This is something that I want. More than want, this is something that I believe in, I love, I call dear. This speaks to something. about who I actually am, or what seems to be a place of being at home or being in this world in a complete way. For some people, it's hearing teachings or reading teachings, that sometimes the teachings are so clear for them that I've had people tell me the scales fell from their eyes. And, you know, they're from one, reading a book, and from one book to, you know, just the scales fell from my eyes, one person said. And then, you know, her whole life was changed in a radically different way. Some people, they hear a Dharma talk, and that Dharma talk somehow does something to them. Wow, I had no idea. One of my favorite little stories, which is not uncommon, is people go to a Dharma talk, and the Dharma talk is about suffering. Oh, these Buddhists. And they're suffering. And they are so inspired because, and it's life-changing, because they grew up in a situation, in a society, in a culture, in a family, schools, whatever. No one ever talked about suffering. It was all hidden, pushed away, denied, avoided at all cost, and or explanations were given for it and just didn't make any sense to them. It wasn't understandable. And then to have hear teachings where suffering is put center stage, we address this, we look at this, we take it seriously. We're the people who really look at suffering. Not to suffer better, but rather to work through it to the other side. This idea of liberation from suffering is the simplest way of talking about liberation in Buddhism. And so some people hear this and it's life-changing. Wow, you can do this? Someone's finally talking about it? Finally, my life makes sense. That's all that makes sense. This is what I want to do in my life. And then some people will change their life and do something totally different. One of my favorite little stories of someone kind of suddenly being changed by their encounter with Buddhism is a friend of mine who was out riding his motorcycle. You know, he just drove over the state in his motorcycle, young man, and drove down this long dirt mountain road and came to the end of the road, and it was Tassajara Zen Monastery. He'd never known anything about Buddhism or anything, but there it was. And he didn't leave. And, you know, later he left, but I mean, but you know, he became a Zen priest and a Zen teacher and the whole thing. So, you know, people encounter things and you know, meet things. And some people, their faith is, I don't know if it's a negative faith. Some people come to a point in their life where they not only have they given up faith in everything else, but they've reached rock bottom. And nothing else matters anymore. Nothing else works. And they're just like in that total desperation of totally nothing makes sense anymore. Nothing works. Somehow or other, well, I might as well try this Buddhist thing. And so they put themselves into that practice, and then something begins to cook and to work for them. And then some people are inspired because something they hear or see in the Dharma resonates very deeply with something inside, that something they already know in themselves, something they've touched and experienced that maybe they don't have words for, and they say, oh, here it is. This is what I've been looking for. This is what I've been trying to find a place for, to express in my life, or to touch into again. It's not uncommon for people to have, for example, spend time in nature a lot as kids. I've met people who grew up in the countryside on farms and stuff, and they were left alone to roam around and spend, you know, lots of hours in the woods, and they touched something in there that was so important for them. And somehow, when they come to Buddhist practice or encounter, they go, oh, that's they're talking about that. Sometimes it's you know, all kinds of small things that we have as children, maybe that we touched. I think not a few people come to Buddhism and rediscover not their inner child, but the inner goodness that they experienced here and there as a child. And, for me, I remember it was after I started doing meditation retreats that During my meditation sometimes, I had this experience of that was kind of in my chest, kind of feeling of wholeness, warmth, certain kind of poignancy of goodness that kind of felt there. And I said, oh, this is the experience that I, as a little kid, maybe 7, 8, 9 years old, that I called on the edge of the pillow. I always happened as I was going to sleep at night. So I was laying on the edge of the pillow, I guess. And I would just be laying there peacefully, and this feeling would well up inside in my chest and my this warmth, this wholeness, this goodness that, and I used to go just feel it, and I didn't know what it was. And, you know, I didn't have any context for it, or it never occurred to me to do anything with it or think too much about it, except I just, oh, there it is, the edge of the pillow experience. How nice. And then some, you know, 20 years later or something close to that, meditating on a week-long retreat, hey, wait a minute. I remember this. I hadn't thought about it for many years. Wait a minute. There it is. That's the experience. And that certainly inspired my faith. You know, wow, this is good. I'm touching something. It's accessible in a way that I never know you could access it, you know, kind of, not exactly on will, but, you know, do something that would touch into this childhood thing. So there's many things that inspire faith, and that faith that gets us started, some people prefer to call it confidence, and some people translate it that way. However, confidence I'd like to reserve for confirmed faith. And that's the idea as we engage in practice, that what started us in the practice, something begins happening to us, we experience for ourselves that, oh, this is right, this is true, this works. We start learning the musical instrument, and after some time, wow, yes, it's true, I can learn an instrument. It took many hours, but I could do it. And I can meditate, I can live a life that's ethical. I can cultivate my compassion, kindness. I can do these things. And I am doing it. And that can give birth to a little bit of confidence. Yeah, I can do it, and I'll get around to it when I retire. No, not then. I'll do it, you know, on my deathbed. But then, you know, you might forget. But to awaken kind of an enthusiasm, yes, I can do it. This is not only worth doing, this is maybe worth doing, putting at the center of my life. And so then it becomes a confidence, and the word, there's actually a Pali word for this kind of confidence. There's two kinds of faith. There's a sada, I reserve the word faith, and then the confirmed confidence is called avecha pasada, which has the meaning of confidence born of knowledge. Confidence comes from knowing something for yourself. And now you don't have to believe it in terms of taking someone else's word for it. You know it. And if you know it, now you can believe it in the sense of loving it, of caring for it. You have something you care for. It's valuable. And now I believe, I love, I care for. And this Bhikkhu Bodhi, the big translator for our texts, he translates this avecha pasada as unshakable faith or unshakable confidence. I forget. Maybe unshakable confidence. That you have unshakability. And certainly myself and other people that I've been practicing for a long time, you get this sense of, you know, this is unshakable. I know this for sure. This is true. This is really possible. This really is something that I want to organize my life around. And it's not uncommon for people to, at some point as the practice deepens, to understand that this movement towards freedom, this movement to no longer be operating under any kind of attachment or clinging or selfishness that so much of life is organized around, that this is not how I want to base my life on anymore. This doesn't make sense to keep that at the center of my life. I'm now going to practice in the direction of putting the Dharma at the center, the practice at the center, which in very personal terms I hope means something like, I'm going to now put at the center my heart's capacity for freedom, my heart's capacity to live with goodness, without greed, hate, and delusion, without selfishness, without being closed or tight or caught up in my entanglements. It's not easy to do that, but that's what I want to be involved in, and that's what I want to put at the center of my life. So so there's a range of what faith and confidence and can mean for people, but as it gets stronger, it becomes a force inside of us. It's not just a policy that we have, like, okay, what should I do today? Well, I think I'll have faith. Check it off, to-do list. Yes, I have faith, and that's it. But rather, it's something that is integral to what we are realizing for ourselves, what we're experiencing for ourselves, what we're actually seeing in ourselves, the change, the movement of practice, what it's like to show up and be mindful and to hold things in a way that is not perpetuating the clinging and the selfishness that can exist. And so it becomes kind of like a force, like a power that protects us, that guides us, that is our friend, that wants the best of us, that's going to protect us from evil, our own evil. It's a strong word, I guess. None of us have evil, but, lousy stuff. And so we call it an Indriya, something of the God, the deity Indra. And maybe now you can begin appreciating that why we might want to interpret this this idea that we have this something that's so special that we'll happily borrow the English word divine, or if we want to anthropomorphize it, is that right? Or deopomorphize it? Call it our divinity inside. The divinity, the divine qualities of faith that we can have. And faith is only one of these five divine qualities inside. So each of the other ones also can be developed and understood and really have this beautiful quality, beautiful kind of force, momentum that lives in us, that grows and develops over time. And we don't have much time to go over the next four, but maybe I can do that next week. But I want to say that each of these, to give you maybe a little sense, to awaken a little bit of a sense in you of how we can relate to these or the role we can have in our lives. There are five actions that we can do in relationship to these five ways of relating to them. So the faith, we can trust the faith. The second, energy, we can enjoy. Most people don't think of effort, like you have to make effort as enjoyment. But this energy, this effort, we can enjoy. That's when it becomes a power, it has more of that quality. Mindfulness, we can love. Mindfulness is something we really can, it's a kind of an object of love. And after all, mindfulness loves you if you give it half a chance. And then the fifth, concentration. I prefer the words samadhi. Concentration, you can revere. Concentration is something to have reverence for. Isn't that something? That kind of speaks a little bit to the specialness of what the samadhi is, that it's something to revere. And then wisdom is something to heed, something to listen to. You have within you capacities, powers, momentums, divinities, divine qualities of wisdom, of understanding, of discernment, that can guide us and support us in the directions we go in our life and how we find our path and how we live. And it's your wisdom. It's not like someone else is telling you what to do. And when that wisdom quality has been evoked, then the relationship we have to it is to heed it. Listen to it. Go along with it. Let it guide you. So five divine qualities inside. I think occasionally in English people call them five spiritual faculties. They are five faculties that you use probably in every activity you're involved in. And it's a fascinating exercise to do, to take some ordinary activity, like driving a car or cooking a meal or, you know, almost anything you do, and you can actually see how each of those five ordinary, very human faculties in some way come into play in what you're doing. Sometimes they come in play because you realize that one of the five is missing or is weak. And so that's one of the things why it's kind of you're getting tripped up in how you're doing it. But you'll see that it's all there. And some things you do are so natural, so easy, you don't realize it, that these are operating or present until you get injured or get sick or something happens and you can't do it. You know, people who can walk think, oh, walking is nothing. And then when you have injuries in your leg, you know, walking is not that easy. And so then it becomes a whole other thing. You realize, oh, I used to have a lot of faith in my ability to walk. It was just so easy, I never had to think about it. But I certainly did, and now I'm not so sure I can. Anyway, it's interesting to look in choose some activities during this week and analyze the presence of these five faculties. And you might find very interesting and enlivening to see how these five play out. Or if you don't understand the other four yet, come back next week. So we have a couple of minutes. If we have any questions that you want to ask or anything you want to say about it, you're welcome to. The mic. Did you want to say something?
No?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So I'm just recollecting that in the Dharmapada, I think it actually says it's especially important to cultivate the five faculties. It's like one of the most important things that we can do. And I think you're hinting at the balancing of the five, how they balance each other out, faith and wisdom, energy, and samadhi, and mindfulness is sort of the anchor in the center. So I just wanted to add that comment.
Great, thank you. Yes, can you move it straight back? You have to turn it on.
What is concentration? I don't know how to turn it on.
What is concentration?
Yeah.
Yeah, come back next week. If I can get through two of them, then I can get to to concentration next week. But concentration, the simple idea for the purposes of these five faculties is that the third one, mindfulness, is our ability to be aware or to recognize what's happening. Concentration or samadhi is the ability of our whole system, not just our control tower, to sustain that awareness through time. So there's awareness and then sustained awareness. And those two aren't radically separate. but many people can have moments of mindfulness, but to have the mind, the awareness, continue in a smooth, easy kind of momentum of its own that really keeps us in the present moment with our experience, that's the function of samadhi. Okay, great. One last one, yes.
Do you mind expounding on the difference between having, say, unshakable confidence and no attachment? Because it seems like they're kind of at a, can be at war with each other in some ways.
I have unshakable confidence that it's good to keep my hand open and not grip anything.
I'll have to think about that.
So there can be a powerful confidence in the value of non-clinging that actually supports us to be relaxed in clinging. And it's interesting you ask this because the word pasada, that's in this unshakable confidence, the word for confidence, it's the word pasada, which also has the meaning of serene or peaceful. So it's not zealous confidence. It's unshakable and strong, but it, built into it is this feeling of peaceful. And at the retreat, one of the teachers was talking about the energy factor, the second effort, and she talked about that the effort needed is should be relaxed and relentless. So there again, we have that problem that you're pointing to, right? Some of these we have this idea that these things can't coexist, and being unattached doesn't have to come with being, now having no energy. It can come with tremendous upsurge of wonderful, healthy vitality that flows into our life, doing things wholeheartedly. So we're going to stop. Yes.
Just a quick PSA.
Yeah. Yeah?
We need to be sure we clean our hands off afterwards.
Oh, Richard says that when you pass the mic, these days we want to clean our hands afterwards. Because who knows who, what came your way. And but, that's true. So one of the ways of living a generous, compassionate, caring life for others is to pick up a new practice. And, they say that you can be awakened, fully, totally enlightened in any activity that you give yourself over to wholeheartedly. Really do this activity like it's the only thing you're doing. At that moment, it's the most only thing to do, the most important thing you do, nothing else, just there for that. So, that who knows? You might get fully, totally enlightened. You might be the next Buddha. If you do that with washing your hands. Wash your hands like this is the one thing that needs to be done. Don't do it impatiently. Don't think about what's next. Don't get over it. If you want to get through washing the hands quickly so you can do the important things in life, then I guarantee that you won't get the full practice potential of washing the hands will be shortchanged. You'll shortchange yourselves. So go forth into the world and take on the practice, the enlightening practice. Make it an enlightening practice to love and have all five faculties come into play as you wash your hands. Enjoy your week. Thank you.